From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, blues singer and guitarist Roy Bookbinder plays some of his favorite songs from the 20s and 30s and talks about his vagabond life. Also today, I speak with lyricist and songwriter Robert Hunter, whose long collaboration with guitarist Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead has produced such rock anthems as Uncle John's Band, Truckin', and Touch of Grey. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Mysterioso, the new album by drummer and bandleader Paul Motion. And television critic David Bianculli previews POV, the new PBS series showcasing independent documentaries. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Roy Bookbinder plays Southern blues and hillbilly music. At the beginning of his career, he sought out the Reverend Gary Davis, who taught him about the blues and took him on tour for a couple of years. Bookbinder also went to the South to track down one of his favorite performers, Pink Anderson, who had played in medicine shows for over 40 years. Before Anderson died, he taught Bookbinder many of his songs. Bookbinder tours continually, living out of his Airstream motorhome. In addition to performing at festivals and state fairs, he's become a regular guest on the Nashville Network's cable TV show Nashville Now. He has an album about to be released on Rounder Records called Bookaroo. When Roy Bookbinder visited our studios, he brought his guitar, and he kicked off our interview with the song Black Dog Blues.
Call me a dog when I'm gone. It's old Black Dog when I'm gone. But when I get home with a $10 bill, is Daddy where you've been so long? Well, I've been all around Kentucky, in the state of old Tennessee. Dog when I'm gone, Lord, Lord, old Black Dog when I'm gone. When I get home with a $10 bill, is Daddy where you've been so long? My daddy was a gambling man from the state of old Tennessee. He taught me to bet all of my money on ace, jack, that deuce, and a tray. Go pick it, Roy. Train, it's coming, carrying my baby away. It's going all far to leave me, ain't never coming back my way. And it's old Black Dog when I'm gone, Lord, Lord, it's old Black Dog when I'm gone. But when I get home with a $10 bill, Daddy, where you've been so long? Black Dog Blues.
Performed by my guest, Roy Bookbinder. You know, I know that you've been singing blues and country blues for many years, and once you were billed in a club as yet another white blues singer, what do you think of that kind of attitude that somehow it's not authentic for people from the North or for white people to be singing Southern-based blues?
Well, I think it's totally wrong, because there's a tradition of, quote, white blues singers throughout the history of country music and blues music. That song I just did, the Black Dog Blues, was originally recorded by a bunch of fellas, a black and white. It was recorded by Bayless Rose, who was a black guitar player and singer, and it was recorded by Dick Justice, both in about 1927. Back in the 20s, it was the record industry that
that decided that white singers were hillbillies and black singers were blues singers. And it had little, it didn't have a whole lot to do with what kind of music was played. It was just a classification, race music for the black race and hillbilly music for the white race. And I know a lot of black singers that were really hillbillies. They wanted to sing certain songs, and the record industry told them, oh, don't do that. We got that saved for so-and-so. And my friend Pink Anderson, his whole life wanted to record My Blue Heaven, and nobody would let him.
Really? Because a black man shouldn't be performing Tin Pan Alley?
Well, it also had a lot to do with the publishing industry. They told the black man, if you come up with a, quote, original blues-type song, we'll give you $50. You want to do My Blue Heaven, you're not going to get a penny because somebody already owns the copyright on it. So the music that the scholarly audience of the 50s and 60s researched and studied so lovingly was not quite as romantic as they all considered it to be, because a lot of it was created by record industry people, as is today.
You know, I think there are a couple of traps that some white northern performers have fallen into when performing southern-based music. And I'm thinking, for instance, that some people seem to have almost lost their own voice when they sing. If they're singing black-based music, they get a completely different voice and try to sound like an older black man from the South. And I wonder if it was ever hard for you to find your own voice in your singing.
Well, I started out with very little, and it's growing. I remember when Bob Dylan's first record came out, I said, okay, I'm going to be a singer. If he can get away with that, I'm going to get away with this. And back in the early 60s, well, I moved south when I was 18 the first time I joined the Navy, ran away to sea, and moved to Virginia, and I've been headed south ever since. And I've been lucky to have been associated with some great masters of the industry. Some of them knew they were masters and others didn't.
Well, you spent some time trying to track down one of the musicians who you liked most, Pink Anderson. Yeah. And he's someone that probably a lot of our listeners aren't familiar with. Tell us a little bit about him, and then
sure.
I'll ask you to do a song by him.
Pink Anderson was from Spartanburg, South Carolina. He made two records in 1929. That was that. He disappeared from the recording industry. And he spent his entire career working medicine shows, little carnival deals throughout the South. He worked with Chief Thundercloud's medicine show up until about 1959. When I met him, he was retired, had a heart attack, and didn't tour at all. He was almost discovered for the folk revival. Sam Chartist recorded a few albums, but he was past his prime, and his health didn't get better, so he stayed, and people like John Hurt and Booker White and Son House came up from the Deep South to play the big festivals. And when I met Pink, he was not in great shape. But me and my friend Paul Jeremiah started to visit him. And, at one point we realized the worst thing about his health was he was starving to death down there. And he started to play again. And we took him out on tour once before he died. And it was quite a deal. Pink Anderson's music, he was a carnival performer. And his songs were white, black, and blue. You know, they were mixed up. The song that I'm going to do next, Traveling Man, has become my theme song, and it's a song that everybody in the folk field always identified with Pink Anderson, knowing that he probably didn't write it. But it's a song that goes back to minstrel shows, and it was probably a song written by a white man on Broadway. Like so many times you get a song from a New York writer on Broadway, what was Tin Pan Alley, and it filters down to the rural community, and then it's found by some folklorist as a what a find. It happened throughout the history of country music and blues. I mean, Hank Williams' greatest hit, if you ask any country singer, it was probably the Lovesick Blues, and that was a song that based on the yodel of Emmett Miller, who first recorded it in 1926. I mean, Hank Williams obviously learned it from that source. And Emmett Miller, who was a white man who sang in blackface in minstrel shows, toured the South in the early 1900s, say between 1915 and 1925. Every country singer, any country boy growing up would have seen a tent show with a minstrel man in there doing a parody of blues. And a lot of what we later listened to was actually a parody of the blues. And the song Lovesick Blues was written by two Russian immigrants in 1916, I believe, on Broadway.
A pretty twisted history.
Yeah.
Can you do a song for us from
sure
Pink Anderson?
Can. This is the old Traveling Man song. Came a long way. Well, I just want to tell you about a man named Boone. His home was down in Tennessee. He made his living. He was stealing chickens and anything that he could see.
That pop-eyed man that said he runs so fast that his feet never stayed in a row. When a freight train passed, didn't matter how fast, he'd always get on board. He was a traveling man, certainly was a traveling man. He was the most travelingest man that ever was in that land. Traveled everywhere, known for many miles around. But he didn't get caught and he never got whooped till the police shot him. You know that the police shot that man with a rifle. The bullet went through his head. People, they were coming from miles around just to see if that boy was dead. They telegrammed down south where his mama lived, and she was all upset with tears. She walked up and opened up the coffin's lid, but that fool had disappeared. He was a traveling man, certainly was a traveling man. He was the most travelingest man ever in that land. Traveled everywhere, known for many miles around. Didn't get caught in and never got whooped till the police shot him down. You know, this boy went down to the spring one day to get himself a pail of water. The distance that the rascal had to go was about 2 miles and a quarter. He got there and got his water and he started back, stumbled and fell down. He ran back to house, got himself another bucket, caught the water before it touched the ground. He was a traveling man, certainly was a traveling man. He was the most travelingest man ever in that. Traveled everywhere, known for many miles around. He didn't get caught and he never got whooped till the police shot him down. Now listen, this boy was out on a Titanic ship the day it was sinking down. He was standing out by the railing, had his head hung down. When that boy jumped overboard, everybody said he was a fool. But about 2 minutes right after that, well, he was shooting dice in Liverpool. He was a traveling man, certainly was a traveling man. He was the most travelingest man ever in that land. Traveled everywhere, known for many miles around. But he didn't get caught and he never got whooped until the police shot him down. Oh, Picket Roy. The traveling man at last, then they had him up to hang one day. The jurymen, they all asked that man just what did he have to say. He begged the jurymen if they would bow their heads in prayer. And then he crossed one leg and he winked one eye and he went up through the air. He was a traveling man.
Pink Anderson teach you that one?
Well, he didn't directly teach it to me, but I watched him play it.
Right.
He actually played it in a different key.
Was he surprised to see you tracking him down, wanting to learn his songs? If he'd only recorded 2 songs, he must have been pretty obscure in musical terms.
Oh, he went nuts when I went down there. I was sitting on his front porch. That's a long story. I don't have time to tell you the whole thing. But he came down the street, and I walked up the street towards him. I was playing the guitar on his step. I looked at him, I said, "You must be Pink Anderson." He said, "How do you know that?" I said, "Lady in the house said you went to the dry cleaners this morning. This is a dead-end street, and you're carrying clothes." He said, "You been to college?" I said, "Some." He thought I was pretty smart. I told him I've been looking for him for 36 hours. He asked me if I owed him money. I said, "No, sir, I owe you money." He says, "You do? How much?" I said, $50. He says, "Give it cheer." So I gave him a $50 bill. He looked at it, snapped it twice, put it in his pocket, and then he inquired how did it come to be that I had owed him this small fortune. I told him I made a record of one of his songs. He said, "Was it a hit?" I said, "You be the judge." We became real good friends. He told me before he died, he says, "Roy," that's what he always called me. I said, "Pink." He says, you know them old songs of mine you can almost play, right? I said, yeah. He says, well, I'm giving them to you. They're yours now. You just tell people Pink Anderson born and getting ready to die in Spartanburg, South Carolina, used to pick a guitar and sing.
Must be really something when someone who's been this obscure person on a rare record actually becomes a human being because you've met them and you see how they live and who they are and what their life has been like.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. It's more incredible now when I think about it than when it happened. When it happened, it was just...
It just happened.
It just happened. There we were, and me and Pink Anderson. It was pretty funny.
I want to talk to you more about your music and about touring with Gary Davis. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Roy Bookbinder, and he's going to play for us some more. We'll be back after this. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Let's talk a little bit about Reverend Gary Davis, who you also met, and I think this was before he had become rediscovered. He'd already been rediscovered?
Oh, he was semi-famous when I met him. He already was living in a little house in Jamaica, Queens.
Well, there must have been people standing online wanting to understudy him.
Well, there were a bunch of us that hung around. I went on the road with him in 65, I think it was. I was just out of the Navy. I was going to college on the GI Bill when I'd met him. And I went to his house and had a guitar lesson, and we seemed to hit it off. I told him I was ready to go on the road with him, and I quit school and went with him. And I traveled with him for about two to three years on and off. And there were a lot of interesting experiences. Reverend Davis was a great guitar player in many different styles. He knew he was about the best there was, and he really was.
What's some of the strumming or finger-picking style that you learned from him?
Well, Reverend Davis, he had a number of styles. He had his simple little style, like he did Candyman, and he did the Cocaine Blues, and he did Delia. And then he'd get a little more complex in his blues, like the Hesitation Blues. Nickel is a nickel and a dime is a dime. A house full of children ain't one of them mine. One of his other styles, and he had an instrumental style where he imitated the piano and played ragtime pieces, which was really fascinating to the young guitar players that came around. There was a lot of interesting things going on in there. It took a lot of time for some of us to get it, some longer than others.
Most blues musicians have many stories to tell about getting ripped off while they were on the road. And I wonder if that was any worse for Gary Davis, since he was blind and it would have been that much easier for people to take advantage
of
him.
Well, he was taking advantage of a lot when he was singing on the streets for many years in Harlem. He'd lose guitars and what have you. First lesson Reverend Davis taught me, we got to our first rooming house out somewhere near Chicago, and Reverend Davis was getting ready to go to bed. He says, now, Roy, you got to understand. He said, we're in a strange city and a strange house here, and I don't like the house much. I said, well, how come? He said, they're not taking care of this house. I said, well, he's a blind man. I said, how do you know that? He said, well, the doorknob's loose. I checked it on the way in. He said, when you go to sleep, the first thing you do, he says, is you take out your knife. He reached in his pocket and pulled out a knife about 12 inches long. I about had a heart attack. He says, you take your knife and you put it under your pillow. He said, then you get your pocketbook. And he reached down his long jaws and pulled out his little leather purse he kept all his money in. He always traveled with some money. He says, you put that inside your pillowcase. He said, somebody comes for your pocketbook, you know where your knife is. You go to sleep with your hand on your knife, and he goes to sleep. Next morning, about 5:30 in the morning, Reverend Davis is screaming, good God the mighty Lord, have mercy. That could mean anything. I said, Reverend Davis, what's the matter? I mean, I was just in dreamland. Get woken up like that. I mean, he was in his 70s, the old blind man, and he was hysterical. I said, what's the matter? He says, they done got my pocketbook. I said, oh, Lord, have mercy. And we're crawling around the room, and he's screaming, who got his pocketbook? How'd somebody get in this room? He knew that door wasn't good, and didn't you hear nobody? My heart was beating a mile a minute. I'm searching all over this room. Finally, I found his pocketbook under the bed. I says, Reverend Davis? He says, Roy? That's what he always called me. I said, I found your pocketbook. All the money's in there. Don't worry. He said, good God the mighty, where was my pocketbook? I said, you got to remember something when you go on the road. He says, what's that? I said, you went to sleep real late and you were tired. And I think you put your pocketbook underneath your pillowcase and your knife inside your pillowcase. And you got it mixed up and your pocketbook fell behind your pillow onto the floor. Oh, he had a fit. Give me that pocketbook. Where's my knife? Put all this stuff away.
Well, I hope this wasn't advice that you actually needed. Has it been dangerous for you on the road?
Oh, the road is a hazardous place. I mean, I've lived 13 years in a motor home called the bus, and there's different kinds of experiences out there. I mean, I grew up in New York City. I was lucky to escape, actually, but there's a whole new world once you cross that GW bridge. I mean, we spent a lot of time in places that when I grew up, the kind of places my mother told me not to go to. And anything can happen and usually does.
Well, I guess you've had to learn how to be not only independent, but physically take care of yourself on the road.
Well, you got to.
Can you play us a song that you learned from Reverend Gary Davis?
Yeah. Let me play a song that I wrote in the style of Reverend Gary Davis.
Great.
It was a song he always did called I'll Be All Right Someday, and I loved that song. Always wanted to learn how to play it. Finally figured out the basics of it and came out with a little arrangement, and I decided I didn't feel comfortable singing the words that he'd wrote for it. It was one of these biblical epics. He had some that went on for 15 minutes, you know. And we came out with this. It's called I'm Going Home Someday. If my road is rocky and my journey's rough, if I stumble and I fall, well, I'll pick myself up, keep marching forward, and I'll drive these blues away. I've been a gambling man, I've been a cheat, I've often lost my way. I've seen the darkness, want to see the light, trying to start a brand new day. Yes, I'm going home, I'm going home, I'm going home someday. Temptation cast aside, won't take no devil ride, I'm going home someday. Wind is blowing hard, rain is coming down, and I can't keep myself warm. But I'll keep searching for better days and a sheltered port from the storm. I'm going home, I'm going home, I'm going home someday. Temptations cast aside, won't take no devil ride, I'm going home someday. Going to see my mother, going to see my father, going to see my baby brother too. And when I get there, I won't have to worry, I'll know just what to do. I'm going home, I'm going home, I'm going home, I say. Temptation cast aside, won't take no devil ride, I'm going home someday.
Great song.
Thank you.
You've been, speaking of another kind of home, you've been touring around for a long time, living in your motorhome, but you're trying to be based more and more in the South. You're performing a lot on a Nashville cable show. You live out of Tampa, Florida, a few months a year, I believe. And you're performing with on a show that I suppose is trying to be, in a way, something like the Grand Ole Opry. Where do you see yourself fitting in to that?
Well, the Nashville Network is a showcase for country talent mostly, though they have all kinds of music. And I tried to get on there for a couple of years. We sent tapes and all kinds of important people sent word that they were missing something. I finally got the call to do it, and it was just it was a great opportunity for me. And after the first show, the producer asked me where I'd been all these years. And I said, my stuff's been on your desk. And we're on there every 8 weeks now, at least.
Is that really different than the folk scene that you've been doing for years? For years, you've been performing folk clubs, yeah. College coffee houses.
Sure.
And you're exposed to a really different kind of listener now, I think.
Right. Well, the goal of any artist is to reach as many people as possible, and don't pigeonhole yourself into playing just to a quote, sophisticated, knowledgeable audience. I mean, the first time I played on the Nashville Now show, we got fan mail from all over the country. I got a letter from an old man in Ohio somewhere, said he first heard this mountain style of guitar playing in 1916, and he hadn't heard it for many years. He said, you just keep doing what you're doing. You're real good at it. Don't let Nashville change you. And what a thrill, I tell you.
That's great. Let me ask you, when you're in a city, as you are today, where do you park your motorhome?
Well, we're out of town there at the Valley Forge place, and we're lucky enough to have somebody drive us in. Though I've parked it in every major city except Manhattan.
Do you just park on the street somewhere?
Yeah, I just take 3 meters and get a lot of quarters.
Gosh. do you lock your doors very carefully? When
I think of
you know, city life, and it just seems very vulnerable to me being parked out on the street.
I'll leave somebody in there with a shotgun.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, see, people up north laugh.
Yeah, that's what you want us to believe. Well, we're almost out of time, and there's so much that I want.
Yeah.
About playing
the Nashville scene and everything. It's an incredible thing to play at a state fair in rural Virginia or someplace, and have people come up to you that would have never gone to a folk festival, would have never gone to a folk club, and would never have listened to a folk
show. So you think it's a self-limiting audience when you do the folk scene?
Definitely.
Does this mean you don't want to be in the folk scene anymore? That
I'll always be part of this. I mean, It's part of the over, you know, the whole thing. It's you got to include everything. I mean, I feel just as comfortable being here as playing the old Gaslight Cafe on McDougal Street or playing at some little nightclub in Biloxi, Mississippi.
Roy Bookbinder has been my guest. He has a forthcoming album called Bookaroo. It will be on the Rounder record label. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Let's listen to something from one of Roy Bookbinder's earlier albums, the album Going Back to Tampa. This is Hunky Tunky.
Going uptown and tell the chief of police, my baby, she quit me, can't find no peace. Lord, going uptown, I'm gonna have to tell the chief of police. I said my baby, she quit me, and I can't find no peace. Well, now my mama, she told me, my papa told me too, don't let this bad-ass women be the death of you. Lord, my mama told me, my papa told me too, don't let this bad-ass women be the death of you. What you gonna do? They tear your bad-ass down. I pack up my suitcase and hunt some other town. Lord, what you gonna do? They tear your bad-ass down. I'm gonna pack up my suitcase. I'm gonna hunt some other town. I says the woman that I'm loving, she stand 5 foot from the ground, telling me, woman, she ain't no hand-me-down. Woman that I'm loving, 5 foot from the ground, says she's a telling me, woman, ain't no hand-me-down. Well, now everybody's talking about their hunky-tunky blues. Good God almighty, don't know what I'm gonna do.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks feature the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with the least known member of the Grateful Dead. Lyricist and songwriter Robert Hunter has had a long collaboration with Jerry Garcia, co-writing such songs as Truckin' and Uncle John's Band. He never performs with the Dead, but as we'll hear, he does occasionally record solo. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews drummer Paul Motion's new album, and television critic David Bianculli reviews a new PBS series of independently produced documentaries that explore such subjects as regional American accents and pet cemeteries. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The leader of Iran has called for an all-out war against the United States. These were the first comments by Ayatollah Khomeini since the downing of an Iranian airliner by a U.S. warship. In Beirut, another religious leader said the U.S. had committed an ugly crime, but it would not affect the fate of U.S. hostages held in Lebanon. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
The comments today by Sheikh Hussein Fadlallah, the religious leader of a pro-Iranian group in Lebanon, eased fears concerning the American hostages. 9 Americans are held in Lebanon. Fadlallah said today, "We find no justification in punishing the hostages for an act they are not related to." Fadlallah did hint at possible retaliation by Iran, a theme that was repeated in Tehran by the country's spiritual leader, the Ayatollah Khomeini. In a speech broadcast on Tehran radio, Khomeini offered condolences to families who had lost relatives aboard the Iranian airliner. He said Iran's fight was one of ideological values against immorality. To doubt this is a treachery against Islam, he said. In London, this is Deborah Amos.
Members of Congress have begun to comment on yesterday's incident in the Gulf. Republican Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana said the commander of the Vincennes acted appropriately. Georgia Democrat Sam Nunn, who chairs the Senate Armed Services Committee, said he would reserve judgment until he received further information. Democratic Senator Alan Dixon says he expects the Senate to continue to back the administration's Gulf policy. Apparent Democratic presidential nominee Michael Dukakis said today that U.S. armed forces have a right to defend themselves when they are attacked. Dukakis said, however, that yesterday's incident is further evidence that the war between Iran and Iraq must end.
As long as this senseless war between Iran and Iraq continues, supplied and prolonged by arms shipments from dozens of nations, as long as we and the entire international community fail to use our combined efforts to stop it, there will be more tragedies, more heartache, and the ever-present risk of more accidents in the Gulf.
In Chicago, Jesse Jackson was more critical of the Reagan administration and called Sunday's incident regrettable. Jackson said it was the culmination of a guided missile and a misguided policy. Vice President George Bush said today there is no reason to change U.S. policy in the Persian Gulf as a result of yesterday's tragedy. Bush, the likely Republican presidential candidate, also said the Navy ship's apparent mistaken identification of the Iranian airplane was understandable because, quote, combat is quite different than the laboratory. Bush spoke with reporters after arriving in Detroit. The United Nations said today a boat carrying 50 refugees from Vietnam has arrived in the Philippines. The boat set out with 110 people, but more than half the passengers died after nearly 7 weeks at sea. More from the BBC's Humphrey Hawksley.
The sea journey from southern Vietnam to the Philippines usually takes less than a week. The survivors on this boat were at sea for 37 days after leaving the port of Trukiang, south of Ho Chi Minh City, on May the 22nd. 110 people, including women and children, were on board the 36-foot vessel. Survivors said the engine broke down after a few days, and as supplies ran out, the refugees began dying one by one. The boat's leader said that after a disagreement, 23 of the Vietnamese built a raft out of materials on board and set out on their own. They are now missing and presumed dead. 10 more of the men are said to have drowned while trying to swim to passing ships. There's been a steady stream of refugees from Vietnam since the late 1970s, with a record 202,000 in 1979. Last year, some 28,000 reached other Asian countries, which are becoming increasingly impatient at international efforts to deal with the problem.
Humphrey Hawksley in Manila. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album by drummer Paul Motion. Kevin says that while other jazz drummers who lead their own bands, like Art Blakey and Max Roach, preserve mainstream values, Motion's band has a more unorthodox approach.
Follow jazz for a while have probably heard of drummer Paul Motion, who's best known for his work with pianists Bill Evans and Keith Jarrett. But Motion's own quintet, founded in 1981, remains one of the jazz world's best-kept secrets. It's also one of my favorite groups. The quintet, whose instrumentation is two tenor saxes, electric guitar, acoustic bass, and drums, has just put out its fourth album, Mysterioso, on the Soul Note label. Most of the tunes are by Motion, but two are by the late pianist Thelonious Monk. Motion's band doesn't sound like Monk's, but like Monk, he puts a weird spin on familiar forms. The drummer can play with quiet grace, but sometimes he plays against the prevailing rhythm, or harps on some clunky pattern, or deliberately drags or rushes the beat. His guitarist Bill Frisell may phrase in an equally obtuse way, or voice sour chords as if he hadn't tuned up in years. Like Monk, these virtuosi may sound deceptively like clowns who can't play their instruments. Here's their version of Monk's blues, Mysterioso. That's drummer Paul Motion with Jim Pepper on tenor sax. Motion's quintet has a more gently romantic side, too, one apparently inspired by the record company this band used to record for, Germany's ECM label. Like an old Hollywood studio, ECM has a house style that may level differences among individual artists. The stereotypical ECM record is dreamily moody and recorded with plenty of softening echo, the aural equivalent of airbrush photography. In this band, guitarist Frisell is often echolalic. He repeats what he hears. Mimicking the other musician's lines, he imitates the ECM sound's rosy glow, but subverts it at the same time. Here's the beginning of Paul Motion's Gang of Five. One of the things I like about this Gang of Five is that they seem to be coming from every direction at once, which, in a sense, they are. Their origins remind us of what a melting pot the jazz world can be. Paul Motion grew up in Providence, in a home where Turkish and Armenian were spoken, while Bill Frisell was the all-American kid. Tenor saxophonist Jim Pepper is a Native American, half Kaw, half Creek. Bassist Ed Schuler is the son of composer and musicologist Gunter Schuler. Joe Lovano follows in the footsteps of his father, Tony Lovano, also a jazz tenor player. With such diverse backgrounds and the different outlooks they imply, it makes sense that the quintet can go from the rhapsodic to the rambunctious and from the delicate to the delirious in no time flat. We're often told jazz is the sound of surprise. Like Thelonious Monk, Paul Motion seems determined to keep listeners off balance every time he hits the bandstand.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Mysterioso, the new album by the Paul Motion Quintet, on the Soul Note label. This is Fresh Air. Jerry Garcia and Robert Hunter met when they were teenagers. Ever since Jerry Garcia formed the Grateful Dead in the mid-60s, Robert Hunter has written most of the lyrics for Garcia's songs, lyrics most Dead fans know by heart.
Well, the first days are the hardest days, don't you worry anymore. 'Cause when life looks like easy street, there is danger at your door. Think this through with me. Let me know your mind. What I want to know is, are you kind?
Truckin', got my chips cashed in. Keep truckin', like the doo-dah man. Together, more or less in line. Just keep truckin' on.
Robert Hunter doesn't perform his songs with the Grateful Dead, but occasionally he steps in front of the microphone to record an album of his own songs. He has a new album called Liberty, for which he wrote both words and music. Jerry Garcia is featured on lead guitar. Robert Hunter sings.
A bird with a tear in his eye, walking to New Orleans, my, my, my. Hey now, bird, wouldn't you rather die than walk this world when you're born to fly?
write different kinds of songs for yourself than you do for the Grateful Dead?
I tend to, when I know that I'm writing for the Grateful Dead, I understand that there's a lot of people out there who are going to be listening to it. And I tend to speak in a more general way. When I'm writing for myself, then I can make a song more personal. I don't, it only needs to reflect my point of view, as opposed to the more Catholic, universal tastes of Grateful Dead appealing to masses.
When you're writing a song with Garcia and he's writing the music, you're writing the lyrics, let me ask that age-old question of which comes first.
Well, what's happening right now is Jerry's coming over to the house every day. We're getting some songs together for a new album, and I give him some starter ideas, and he looks at those, and we just batter it back and forth and back and forth. These songs for Grateful Dead are true collaboration for the most part. There are times when I've handed him lyrics and he's set them, other times when he's handed me accomplished changes and I've put words to those. But when it works best is when we actually get our heads together and battle it back and forth until there's something that we mutually agree on.
The Dead have a huge tribal following. Do those people know about your own records, and do you think that a lot of them buy your records?
There's an element that buys my records. It tends to be more the intellectual part of the Deadhead scene. You know, I don't generally put out a lot of dance type music. Tend to a more serious introspective music. But on the Liberty album, I'm making a little bit of a try to make something that'll hit on both levels.
When you were traveling with the band, and the people who were on stage would get so much attention, would you ever feel a little left out as the lyricist who wasn't on the stage basking in all the glory?
Oh, you bet I did. Oh, it was misery. All those jerks up there getting all that glory and all the girls and everything like that, and just miserable. All I had was my spiral notebook. Yeah, boy. Well, I'll get even.
Can you confirm this for me? I read somewhere that you were one of the participants in the Stanford University program of government experimentation with LSD in the early 1960s?
Yeah, they paid me $140 to take first LSD, second psilocybin, I think third mescaline, and then the fourth week all three of them together.
No kidding.
which was a joy in one way, but they also came and took 5 cc's of blood every 2 hours, and when you're hoinged out on acid, here comes Dracula again.
Oh, gosh, what did they tell you about LSD before they gave it to you the first time?
Nothing. They didn't want me to know a thing about it, and I lied to them. I told them that I knew nothing about it, and I had read Doors of Perception, in fact.
Oh, and that's why you wanted to be in the program, probably.
Yeah. And they called it, the word at the time was psychotomimetic drugs, miming psychosis, and they wanted to find out if it increased your ability to be hypnotized and to take suggestions. And I don't know what they found out from that. I was sitting there, and they were trying to run these little hypnotic things on me, I remember, and all of a sudden tears began running out of my eyes, and the psychologist said, well, what's happening here? And I said, well, it's kind of hard to describe, but I'm out in the fifth dimension somewhere, and I'm a great jade green Buddha, and there's a pool growing out of my lap, and it's just, and the water of the pool is running out of my eyes. I'm not really crying, you know. I think they began twigging that they were onto something a little bit more than a simple heightening of suggestibility here.
Do you think that tripping a lot changed the kind of lyrics that you were writing?
Oh, it had to.
Yeah.
It had to. I mean, I was tripping around in mystic space and making the mystic connections, which I think were right for the time. I look back on that stuff with a great deal of affection. I know where it comes from, and I think people do. It was part and parcel of that generation. Don't write like that anymore, but I don't take the drug anymore.
I figure if I had a nickel for everyone who got really high and listened to your lyrics and tried to figure out the more elliptical imagery, that I'd really be a wealthy woman. What are some of the crazier interpretations you've gotten of some of your song lyrics?
Oh, heavens. Well, there was a time, it may still be so, when people would swear that I was writing about them. And if something is personal enough, there's a certain line where it becomes universal. It's, you never know which ones will and which ones won't. I've written things which are so personal, nobody could ever have the slightest idea, like, you know, Look for a while at the China Cat, Sunflower Proud, Walkin' Jingle in the Midnight Sun. Now, that gets into kind of Joycean word salad, and some people, strangely enough, know just what I mean by it, but don't, I couldn't explain that.
Can I ask you about a song? You know the song Uncle John's Band?
Mm-hmm.
One of the lines is, when life looks like easy street, there's danger at your door.
Oh, God, is that true?
Were you thinking of something specific when you wrote that?
I was thinking about the sort of the hippie self-congratulatory thing that we've really conquered all this. You know, here we've entered the Vietnam War, we've done this, the other thing, and things looking rosy. No, it's liberty. The price is eternal vigilance.
With your new album, Liberty, out, I'm wondering if you're at all shy about performing.
I'm thinking about it. Now, I haven't been out. I did a national tour last year for a month, but I just go out by myself or with my wife. I don't have any entourage. We book ourselves and we get ourselves from place to place, and it's the way I choose to do things. And it's hard. It's very hard. I think I will go out again, but I am aware that I'm robbing from my writing time when I do this, and I think I'm more valuable to people as a writer than I am as a performer, a stage performer.
Robert Hunter, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, you're welcome, Terry.
Robert Hunter's new album, Liberty, is on Relics Records. He's also done a new translation of the Duino Elegies by Rainer Maria Rilke, published by Hula Gosi Books in Eugene, Oregon. Hunter spoke to us from station KQED in San Francisco. Listening to Fresh Air.
All the news coming up later on All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. On today's program, we follow up on the downing of the Iran Air jetliner in the Persian Gulf. The Iranians charge it was premeditated murder, an act of terrorism, they say, and Ayatollah Khomeini has urged Iranians to wage all-out war against the United States in retaliation. The U.S. has sent a message of regret to Iran, but President Reagan has said the act was understandable, and he has ruled out any comparisons between the downing of the Iran air jet and the downing of Korean airliner Flight 007 by the Soviet Union some years ago, saying in that case, Soviet jets flew up, identified the plane, and still shot it down. Those stories and more coming up later today on All Things Considered.
Independently produced documentary films are seldom broadcast on television, but a new series starting this week on PBS is aimed at making them more regular fare. Television critic David Bianculli has a review.
As far as I'm concerned, David M. Davis is one of the unsung heroes of public television. As the executive director of American Playhouse, he jumped over two big hurdles that used to keep most quality drama anthologies off PBS: the financial cost and the artistic risk. To cut costs, Davis pursued a bunch of intricate co-production deals, so the dramas shown on American Playhouse would sometimes premiere earlier elsewhere, as a theatrical movie maybe or as a cable TV special. And to allow for more variety and originality than usual, Davis spread the power base for American Playhouse among several PBS member stations and courted the input and approval of all the others. Starting this week, Davis is using the same 1-2 punch as the executive director of a new anthology series. But where American Playhouse deals with drama, this new series, called POV, is designed to showcase the independent documentary. POV stands for Point of View, and that's the key behind this 10-week series. Even though PBS has gotten really skittish about presenting documentaries with points of view, remember the flap over the Africans? Davis and executive producer Mark N. Weiss have built a framework that allows for different voices to be heard. In fact, the series leads off with a documentary called American Tongues, a delightful look at how differently Americans speak, and how those differences sometimes spark bigoted reactions.
Who do you think has a funny accent? people from New York or Philadelphia, you know, and Virginia especially. Our grandkids in Virginia, and they have that Virginia dialect, you know. I have to live twice to catch on, you know, to get that dialect, you know.
Wisconsin people.
Why do you say Wisconsin? What do they sound like?
Because when they say their O's, they're going out. Out and about. They do, they're really bad. They sound like they're Norwegian.
Mississippi and Georgia, they had a certain way of talking that, boy, you know how to have a knife to cut it, like trying to cut butter.
People from Chicago and people from New York, upstate New York and all that, all of them have a definite accent. And they're the ones that are hard to understand. They may think I'm...
American Tongues was originally shown last September on cable TV's The Discovery Channel. And most other films on the POV roster have been shown theatrically or on local public TV. Later in this summer season, the POV documentaries include Gates of Heaven, a film about pet cemeteries, Best Boy, about a 53-year-old retarded man moving away from home, and Rated X, which sort of looks at sex the same way American Tongues looks at accents. Presenting these films in a weekly showcase like Frontline does gives them a bigger audience and a little more instant credibility. And if some of them are more emotional than balanced, well, that's the whole point. Most of the network documentaries have balanced themselves into blandness. There are no harvests of shame anymore. And the few people on TV who do come off as passionate usually come off as idiots, too, like Geraldo Rivera and Morton Downey Jr. To me, a good documentary should be like that old spinning plates act on the Ed Sullivan Show. You don't want everything to come crashing down, but if there's too much balance, it's not as entertaining or as compelling.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. On tomorrow's show, I'll talk with the king of the paperbacks, Harry Whittington. Since the 1950s, Whittington has written in whatever style the market favored, from detective novels to historical romances and Mandingo sagas. His crime novels are being republished by Black Lizard Books. Also, book critic John Leonard will review Scott Donaldson's biography of the late John Cheever. And rock historian Ed Ward will profile the British group Move, which later became the Electric Light Orchestra. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome the member stations of Wisconsin Public Radio, which joined Fresh Air today. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Our engineers are Bob Alls and Richard Parker. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.